All right. Good morning, everyone. So being that this is our last class for the semester and also before Pesach, I figured I would take the opportunity to focus a little bit on some of the inyanim of Pesach, specifically to focus on what I think is a very intriguing part of the Haggadah. So just a word about the Pesach Seder. The Seder is important to understand. The Seder is not an experience contained onto itself. The goal of the Pesach Seder is to kind of create the energy or to frame the entirety of the Yom Tov of Pesach. So what unfolds over the course of the Seder is, again, not just to be experienced that night, or for us in Chutz La'aretz for two nights, but ultimately, again, to kind of pave the way forward through the entirety of the Yom Tov of Pesach. The themes of the Seder, the mitzvos of the Seder, are crucial pillars to the entire Yom Tov experience. As such, again, you know, the Seder is always a difficult experience for one simple reason, that usually the Seder is perhaps one of the most profound, overwhelming, and cathartic experiences we have over the course of the entire year. The problem or the challenge is that by the time many of you, especially, I'm sure, get to the Seder, you're thoroughly exhausted and overwhelmed. So I'm going to say something that probably is going to get me in a lot of trouble, but I'm going to say it regardless. I would urge you to think ahead in your Pesach preparations. Erev Yom Tov is always frenetic, and always your Erev Yom Tov is always challenging, no matter how much you prepare beforehand. But... at the end of the day, like most things in life, if you plan ahead, then things always go smoother. The worst thing that could happen is a person gets to the Pesach Seder and they're so exhausted from everything that's happened that they don't even have the ability to take advantage of the beautiful opportunity that unfolds that night. It's better to make your menu simpler. It's better to have less side dishes. It's better to have all... you could cut back on a lot of things. Remember, the goal, the Ribono Shel Olam doesn't care how many kugels you have. And the truth is, to be honest, no one is going to remember how many kugels you have. But if a person goes into Yom Tov a little bit more like a mensch, a person goes into Yom Tov spiritually prepared, even if it means, again, that I have to readjust my material preparations, Yom Tov is supposed to be enjoyable. For too many of you, Yom Tov, especially Pesach, becomes something that people shudder. You say Pesach, it's like saying a four-letter word. Right? You say Pesach, Pesach is a gift. Yom Tov is a gift. Everything in Yiddishkeit is a gift. And if it stresses you out, if it's anxiety-provoking, then you are doing it the wrong way. Everything in Yiddishkeit requires an incredible amount of work, and everything requires an incredible amount of preparation. But preparation for something doesn't have to be onerous, or difficult, or anxiety-provoking. Preparation for something you love, something you enjoy, something that's special, the preparation itself could be enjoyable. The preparation itself could be meaningful. Readying a home, readying a mishpacha, readying oneself for the Yom Tov of Pesach is in and of itself avodas and melechas hakodesh. As long as we approach it with the right mindset. So the Pesach Seder sets the tone not only for the Yom Tov of Pesach, but sets the tone ultimately really for the entire year. You know, there's a machlokus in Gemara as to when exactly the new year starts. When is Rosh Hashanah? There are two opinions. One opinion says Tishrei, one opinion says Nisan. We effectively adopt both opinions. Our calendrical new year is Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah. Again, that's why that's the day of judgment as well, the Yemei Hadin. But ultimately, on many different levels, as a people and really as individuals, Nisan, Rosh Chodesh Nisan, the Yom Tov of Pesach, is our Rosh Chodesh. It's our brand new beginning. It's our brand new opportunity. Pesach contains within it the ability to start anew. Pesach contains within it the ability to remake and reforge our identities, but only if you know what the Yom Tov is about, and only if you know how to tap into that energy. So I want to share with you one interesting piece of the Pesach Seder that I think helps to shed light on not just the Seder, and not just on this particular aspect, but I think on the Yom Tov in general. So if you look at number one, I just quoted you over here from the Haggadah, Yachatz. So again, we know, as we go, the beginning of the Seder is at least parts of it are pretty intuitive. So we begin the Seder, of course, with Kaddish. So Kaddish, again, is Kiddush. That's not unique. That's part of every Shabbos in Yom Tov. We have Urchatz, which, again, we're not going to get into the details of this, but the more the ceremonial washing prior to partaking of Karpas. And then we come to Yachatz. Yachatz, on a very simple level, as you can see, the instructions are here. We have three matzahs as part of the Seder. We take the middle matzah, break the middle matzah, take the larger half, set it aside for the Afikoman, and the smaller second half remains in between the two matzos. I'll tell you, interestingly enough, just skip around a little bit. If you skip to number 6 for just a moment, Rav Soloveitchik actually points out something fascinating, which is b'inyan yachatz. Yachatz eino muskar b'gimara. So I'll show you something amazing. Yachatz is not mentioned in the Gemara. There is no Talmudic reference to Yachatz. If you look at almost all of the parts of the Seder, they could all be traced back to the Gemara. Most of what we do in the Seder is found in the 10th chapter of Maseches Pesachim, but yet Yachatz is nowhere to be found. Yachatz is not there. The earliest source Rav Soloveitchik identifies is Rav Yosef Tov Elam, who is an 11th century Tosafist who lives in Provence. That's the earliest source we have for Yachatz, so the breaking of the middle matzah. I don't know if he initiated it, but it's one of the earliest sources that we have for it. So already this is intriguing, because in general, to have something that's part of the Pesach Seder that is not muskir b'gimara, that is not brought down in the Gemara, indicates to us that the rabbis chose to include it, because not because I'm discharging an obligation. There is no particular mitzvah in Yachatz. Meaning, if one doesn't do Yachatz, are you a good Jew? Everybody's a good Jew, right? Baruch Hashem, Rosh Hashanah loves us no matter what we do. But if one doesn't do Yachatz, one still fulfills the mitzvahs of the night, one still fulfills the rabbinic obligations, the biblical obligations. Yachatz is part of the Seder, even though it's not mentioned in the Gemara, because the rabbis felt that there was an important symbolism. If you take a look at number 2, so the Shulchan Aruch writes, V'yikach matzah ha'emtsois v'yitzen l'shtayim. You take the middle matzah, you break it into 2 pieces, now you'll notice the wording over here is very interesting. So the Shulchan Aruch writes that you go out and you take the larger half and you give it to someone at the Pesach Seder, someone else at your table to watch it. Lafikoman, frafikoman. Remember again, well, we'll come back to that in just a moment. Vinostin osatachas hamapa, and you're supposed to purposely put it underneath a cloth. So you take the afikoman, you hand it to someone at the Seder, and that person ultimately watches it until the afikoman. Based on this, interestingly enough, the Beis Halevi in number 3, I put a lot more on the sheet than we're going to cover today, but the Beis Halevi says something amazing. Why do we eat the afikoman? Remember, what does afikoman mean? Dessert. Afikoman is not a Hebrew word. Afikoman is a Greek word, epikoman, which means dessert. The afikoman is our zecher, is our remembrance to the Karban Pesach, to the Paschal Lamb. You can see you really want the Beis Hamikdash when you're eating a piece of matzah instead of lamb. But the afikoman is there to remember the Karban Pesach. The Beis Halevi makes an amazing halachic observation, which is Karban Pesach was unique in that it required shmira. It had to be guarded from the time it was slaughtered. Now, in Egypt already, it was guarded already for days, from the 10th of Nisan already up until the bringing of the Karban Pesach. That was unique in Egypt. That was not part of ongoing Paschal service, Pesach service. But by Karban Pesach, the meat itself requires shmira, requires attentiveness and vigilant attentiveness from the time of slaughter until the time of consumption. So the Beis Halevi says something very beautiful. The Beis Halevi says that piece of matzah, which is supposed to represent the Karban Pesach for us, what do? We wrap it up and we give it to someone to watch, symbolizing or recreating the Karban Pesach experience. Just like the Karban was supposed to be guarded, so too the piece of matzah, which represents the Karban, is guarded as well. Now I know what you're thinking. The Shulchan Aruch, right, doesn't sound like what we do, because contemporary practice has become that what? We break the Afikoman, and the Afikoman is stolen. So I'll share with you something very interesting. So first of all, if you take a look at number 5, I'm proud that I'm going back and forth a little bit, Shlomo Zalman Arbach Zeker Tzadik Livrach is quoted. There's a series called Yushalayim B'Mo'adeh, written by Rav Nevin Zal. There's a Talmud Mufak of Rav Shlomo Zalman. So he writes over in the name of Israel, B'Shem HaMaran, HaGon Rav Shlomo Zalman Arbach, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, Shalo Haisa Daito Nocha Mimina Gneva Safikomen. Rav Shlomo Zalman was against the practice of having children steal the Afikomen. Why? Kedei Shalo Yisraglu Lignov. We shouldn't habituate our children to stealing. This dealing, which by the way is a very profound statement. Rav Shlomo Zalman is saying is children, especially younger children, are concrete thinkers. What does concrete thinking mean? There's black and white. There's right and wrong. Younger children do not understand the concept that certain things may be permitted in one context, but not in a different context. So Shlomo Zalman said, we teach our children to be moral, ethical people. And then on Leil HaSeder, you're telling them to steal? You can't habituate your children, say, which was just, by the way, you think to yourself, really, like, my biggest problem in child rearing should be that my kid steals the Afikoman. But Rav Shlomo Zalman is saying something so profound. Parenting is a very nuanced art. And ultimately, again, our children pick up cues and our children learn things from everything we do. Big and small. Therefore, Rav Shlomo Zalman was against the practice of stealing the Afikoman. He is a Das Yochid, right? So again, that's certainly not the Minhag Yisrael. The Minhag Yisrael is that the children do steal the Afikoman. Where does that practice come from? So remember, again, this is all very intriguing, because Yachas itself, the breaking of the middle Masa, is not mentioned in the Gemara at all. As we saw, earliest source, Rav Yosef Tov Elam, 11th century prevents. So obviously, if Yachas is not mentioned in the Gemara, then ultimately the stealing of the Afikoman is not mentioned in the Gemara as well. So where did this practice come from? So it evolved over the years. I don't know when it started, but on a simple level, the point of stealing the Afikoman is to keep the children engaged. And it's an incredible mechanism, because remember again, Yachatz is at the beginning of the Seder. The Afikoman is only consumed after the meal, right before Birkas was, right before benching. So essentially, it's a ploy to keep the children engaged over the entirety of the Seder. Specifically for which part? Specifically for Magid, right? For Magid, which is a different discussion about, I can't tell you how many people walk around with negative feelings towards Yiddishkeit because their parents forced them as children to stay at the table for the Seder. Don't force your children to stay at the Seder. They should sit for a little bit. They should be happy. They should enjoy it. But if at the end of the day they don't want to be the kids, kids are kids. Most adults have difficulties sitting at the Seder the entire time. The difference is, as adults, many of us have mastered the ability to look interested or to look engaged, while at the other time be somewhere dramatically different. Children are much more sincere. So children can't do that. If they're not interested or not engaged, but again, a parent has to do this with chachma. Remember, what's the goal of the Seder? The goal of the Seder is not to go ahead and end at 3 o'clock in the morning. If you want to, that's fine. The goal of the Seder is not just to gobble up the matzahs and to drink the wine. The goal of the Seder is that your children should love the Ribono Shel Olam, should love Yiddishkeit, that your children should say, wow, it is such a privilege to be a Jew. Thank you, Ribono Shel Olam, for taking us out of Mitzrayim so that I can actualize that identity. So if your kid loves to sit by the Seder, fantastic. Wonderful. Zachis, that's wonderful. If your child is like most other children, maybe you'll get 15 minutes, 20 minutes, a half hour, maybe a different spurt. It's wonderful. Whenever they're ready to engage or however they're ready to engage, take what you can get. But chas v'shalom, don't make it into an experience that a child resents because the parent is forcing them to be by the table. Obviously, every parent has to know their child and what their child is capable of. It's not a failure in parenting if the kid doesn't want to stay at the Seder the whole time. It's not a failure in the child if the kid doesn't want to stay the whole time. Children are children. And also as adults, it forces us. Again, it's beautiful. I'm going to tell you a little secret. It's beautiful to have Divrei Torah. It's beautiful to have Divrei Torah. But, you know, especially if you have Baruch Hashem, a person has a mishpacha, you know, every single kid shows up to the Pesach Seder, you know, with a 7-ring notebook. And on one hand, again, it's beautiful. I'm so happy. And on the other hand, I'm already doing the math on this one, right? We're like, really? So again, it's all about pre-planning. And it's all about saying, okay, who's going to take this part of the Seder? And by the way, good news, you might have heard, there are many, many meals over Yom Tov, right? Divrei Torah don't just apply at the Seder. In fact, again, sometimes people peak at the Seder, and then often the lunch meals are kind of just like, everybody's exhausted. Again, one should have Torah at those meals also. So it's all about proper planning. Again, like everything else in life, preparation. You can't start thinking about the Seder of the Seder when you sit down because it's too late. You got to do the math. You have to figure out how many kids, how many Divrei Torah, who's going to do what, who's going to take ownership over this. And like that, you make it an enjoyable experience for the adults and an enjoyable experience for the children. Chazal understood this. You think kids are different now than they were in the times of the Gemara. If they were, then Chazal would not have invented a whole bunch of things to keep the kids engaged. The rabbis were doing this already. In times of the Gemara, kids didn't want to sit at the table. You think this is a new, this is Niskatnu Adonos? Okay, our children might have unique challenges, but at the end of the day, kids are kids. Most children, when given the opportunity to run around and play versus sit at the table and hear about something that occurred 2,000 years ago, right? Most children are going to choose the playing. The rabbis understood this as well. That's why the rabbis tried to use imagination with how to keep the children engaged. So the stealing of the afikoman, as we all know, is a way to keep the children engaged from the beginning of the Seder, hopefully until the end of the Seder. But what I'd like to try to focus on a little bit is, so what is the symbolism? What is the deeper symbolism? Whenever you find something introduced by Chazal that is not found in the Gemara, so our antennas go up. Because remember again, there's more than enough. There is a voluminous amount of rabbinic mitzvos and symbolism that already exist in the Talmud. When the rabbis come along and institute something that's not originally found in the Gemara, so we have to ask ourselves why. What's the message? What's the lesson that Chazal were trying to teach us through this breaking of the middle matzah, through the afikoman? So there are a variety of different approaches with this. I put more on the sheet than what we are going to go ahead and deal with. Now, if you take a look at number 9, 7 and 8, the Beis Yosef and Halik Shor Shlomo Zalman give more halachic answers. If you take a look at number 9, the Das HaKinim says so beautifully, U'bitziyosa zecha l'kriyas yamsuf v'yardin shenifka b'Pesach. So beautifully, the Das HaKinim, which are the Tosafist commentary on the Chumash, say that the splitting of the middle matzah is there for what purpose? To remember the splitting of the sea. In fact, remember, we have two seas that split, right? Remember, it was the Yam Suf, but also the Yarden. The Jordan River also split when Klal Yisrael went ahead and came into Eretz Yisrael. So the Das HaKinim says so beautifully that breaking of the middle matzah represents Kriyas Yam Suf and the splitting of the Yarden. Now, what's amazing about this? What's amazing about this is as follows. This symbolism seems to be totally out of chronological order. Why? Because remember again, the Seder follows an order. The Seder follows a Seder. Right? Remember again, as the Gemara says, Maschil Beginus Omesayim Beshevach. The Seder starts Beginus. Beginus literally means the degradation or the low points of the Jewish experience. And Omesayim Beshevach and ends with praise, literally the high points. So the low points, again on a basic level, refers to we begin the Pesach Seder with a discussion of servitude, and then ultimately, again, we move on afterwards to what? We move on afterwards to emancipation and redemption. That's the way, and by the way, it goes even further. The Seder is actually comprised of three parts, which we'll discuss. The first part is Avodah Minu L'Parah Mitzrayim, we speak about servitude. Then we speak about Yetzias Mitzrayim, Exodus. And then remember, the last part of the Seder is really focused on what? Messianic redemption. That's why if you notice again, after benching, everything shifts. The first thing we do after benching is we pour the kosher Elio. We pour the cup of Elijah. Everything becomes messianically focused after the Seder. So interestingly enough, if the first part of the Seder is focused on servitude and suffering, yet amazingly enough, what are we doing right at the beginning of the Seder, even before we go ahead and we begin Avodah Mayinu? You know, what are we doing? We're breaking the middle matzah, highlighting the splitting of the sea. Almost to teach us that the incredible power of the optimism and hope of the Jew. There is no such thing as just speaking about suffering by itself. There's only one day out of the entire year that we only focus on suffering, and that's when? That's Tisha B'Av. And even then, we don't do it a whole day. We do it until midday, and then we once again become redemption-focused. That's it. Any other time when we speak about suffering, difficulty, tragedy, always laced with optimism. So it's almost as if what the Das HaKinim is saying, that right before we begin to launch into the narrative of Avodim Hayinu Lepara B'Mitzrayim, an Egyptian servitude was barbaric. An Egyptian servitude was horrific. You know, often we think Egyptian servitude is servitude. They were slaves. Okay, we were slaves. What's the big deal? We couldn't choose our employer. We know that's not the case. They were throwing our children into the Nile. They were throwing the children into the buildings that Klal Yisrael was constructing. There was incredible bloodshed. There was incredible tragedy, incredible suffering. But yet, what do we do? Right, even before we launch into that narrative, we remind ourselves, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. We break the middle matzah, we got out of Mitzrayim, we got into Eretz Yisrael, and at the end of the day, that is always the story of our people. We suffer, we may fall, we may suffer setbacks, we may suffer unspeakable tragedies, but at the end of the day, we always make it through. It's Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker, the eternality of the Jewish people is always guaranteed. That's the breaking of the middle matzah, symbolizing redemption of the splitting of the sea, even before we get into the narrative of the servitude of Egypt. If you take a look at number 10, this is another beautiful insight. This is from a wonderful Haggadah called the Historical Haggadah, written by Rav Nachman Cohen. Rav Nachman Cohen was a Rav in Riverdale, New York, an exceptional, exceptional Talmud Chacham. So he wrote this thing called the Historical Haggadah, where essentially he tries to take all of the practices of the Seder and go ahead and try to link them to the historical origins. So he writes over here something very beautiful. The three matzos are reminiscent of the three temples, three Batei Mikdash. The middle matzah symbolizes the second temple. In the second temple, five major components were absent. The Aron, Ark of the Covenant, Urim V'Tumim. Remember again, the Urim V'Tumim refers ultimately again to the piece of parchment with the 72-letter name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that was inserted in the fold of the breastplate of the high priest of the Kohen Gadol. That's what allowed the Urim V'Tumim to come alive. The Urim V'Tumim was a mechanism through which either the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, or the king would communicate with the Ribono Shel Olam. That piece of parchment with the 72-letter name of God, that was like the battery. That's like the spiritual battery for the Urim V'Tumim. That was missing. The divine presence, the Shechina, did not reside in the second Beis HaMikdash. The prophecy, Nevuah, and the heavenly fire which descended to light the pyre. And remember again, in the first Beis HaMikdash, a fire came down from Shamayim to consume the karbanos on the outer altar. That did not happen in the second temple. Since these comprise the major spiritual components of the temple, we hide the larger of the broken pieces until the second half of the Seder. So this is actually beautiful. Rabbi Cohen, and again, the Medrash already brings down this idea that the three matzos represent the three temples. Bayis Rishon, Bayis Sheni, and Emirat Hashem, Bikarov Bayis Shlishi, the third Beis HaMikdash. We take the second matzah, which represents Bayis Sheni, we break it in half. Why do we break it in half? And we remove one half, representing the idea that the second Beis HaMikdash was incomplete. But then something amazing happens. We hide the larger pieces until the second half of the Seder. That portion of the evening is devoted to future redemption. When we begin the second part of the Seder, we recover that larger piece of matzah to illustrate that in the Messianic era, all of the elements missing in the second temple reappear. So beautifully, we go ahead in that second piece of matzah, which is called the afikoman. Again, we're dual-purposing that piece of matzah. We hide it away until right before benching. Already at that point in time, the theme of the Seder has already shifted. The Seder is no longer about historical redemption, but it's about future redemption. We bring back that second piece of matzah to symbolize that what? That in the future when Mashiach comes and we'll have a Bayis Shlishi, all of those things which were missing from the second Beis HaMikdash ultimately again will return in the third. If you look at number 11, again, these are all different symbolisms of Yachatz. They're all correct, meaning it's not the beautiful part is you don't have to choose. You could have it all. So look at number 11, another beautiful and magnificent symbolism. There is an incredible Gemara, La'asid Lavo. This Gemara is quite dramatic. La'asid Lavo, Yomar La'akadosh Baruch Hu Yavram. La'asid Lavo means in Messianic redemption. Now understand, Messianic redemption is preceded by major judgments. Right, there's collective judgment, individual judgment. So before Mashiach comes, in that age of divine judgment, HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to Avraham Avinu with one simple message. What's the message? Banecha chatu. Your children have sinned. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Avraham Avinu, what should we do over here? Your children, Klal Yisrael, have sinned. Amar lefanav ribono shel olam, yimachu akidusha shmecha. God, if they've done the crime, then they have to be punished. If they've sinned, literally again, let them be erased for the sanctity of your name. Avraham Avinu says, if they have sinned, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you have to mete out divine justice. You have to dispense divine justice, and if whatever they need to be punished, they should be punished. Amar, Emra le Yaakov, dehavei leitza gidol banim. So listen to this. This is very important. The Ribono shel Olam is looking for an advocate. Do you know, the worst aveira a Jew could ever commit is to speak negatively about another Jew. The one thing HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to be able to do more than anything is to advocate and to defend one another. What was the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu? The greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu was his ability and his willingness to advocate for Klal Yisrael to the point of chutzpah. Remember again, when we look in the aftermath of the sin of the golden calf, so Klal Yisrael did something horrible. Yet Moshe Rabbeinu defends them. Not only does he defend them, but what does he do? He threatens God. If you don't go ahead and spare the people, machinina mesifracha, erase. I don't want any part of this. Don't try that at home. Right? I don't want any part of this. But the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu was his willingness to defend Klal Yisrael. You know, we're not always an easy people. As a collective and as individuals, we have a lot of opinions, many of them right, some of them wrong. We have many different shitas, many different tashkafas, and sometimes we get annoyed with one another. And it's easy to speak ill or negative of one another, but a Jew is never permitted to disparage another Jew. You should never disparage any person, but certainly not your fellow Jew. Our job is to be an advocate for one another. So here HaKadosh Baruch Hu goes in and he sees that Klal Yisrael is sinning. See, he wants the avos, he wants the patriarchs to advocate. So he comes to Avram, your children have sinned. What does Avram Avinu say? Punish them. Okay, punish them. Comes to Yaakov. So he goes to Yaakov. He says, why does he come to Yaakov? Dehavei leitzar gidol banim. You know, Yaakov knows what it's like to deal with difficult kids. So he says, maybe Yaakov will have a bit more empathy, could relate a bit more to my circumstances, and will advocate. Efshir d'vay rachmi alayu. Amar le, number 11, third line. Banecha chatu. Yaakov, your children have sinned. Amar lefam levribono shel olam yimachu al kiddush hashmecha. So listen to this. Yaakov says, God, if they've sinned, then punish them. Let them be erased. Amar, Ribono Shel Olam is getting exceptionally upset. Lo b'sabi taima, the old man, reference to Avram, has no reasoning. Velo b'dardiki eitza, and the young man has no counsel. Now, the Ribono Shel Olam was looking for someone to advocate, and he's upset that either Avram or Yaakov advocated on behalf of Klal Yisrael. If you'll notice again, who does he skip? Yitzchak. Why does he skip Yitzchak? Because Yitzchak's midah is din, is strict justice. Avram is chesed, Yaakov is gevura. Gevura itself is a derivative of chesed as well. See, he goes to the two patriarchs who represent some element of chesed, thinking they're going to advocate on another. So yeah, I'm not going to Yitzchak. Yitzchak is strict justice. But of course, God, the Ribono Shel Olam, struck out twice. So therefore, he comes to Yitzchak. Amar lo Yitzchak, banecha chatu. Listen to this exchange. He says, Yitzchak, Yitzchak, your children have sinned. Amar lefan of Ribono Shel Olam. So Yitzchak says, Ribono Shel Olam, let's get something straight. Banai v'lo banecha. See, the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu is talking is often a conversation that repeats itself in many homes. Right? Look what your kids just did. Right? Look what your kid just did. So the first thing Yitzchak says is, excuse me, Ribono Shel Olam. My kids, are they not your children also? I'm sorry, this is not right. So when they do what you like, when they say Nasa v'nishma, then they're your kids. But when they do something wrong, now they're my kids. So the first thing that Yitzchak Avinu says to Ribono Shel Olam, don't make this my problem. This is our problem. This is our problem. I'm not looking. They are my children. Absolutely, Yitzchak says. But they're also your children. So let's collaborate in finding a solution here. Furthermore, look what Yitzchak Avinu says. He says, furthermore, Vod, kamachatu. How much could they really have sinned? Now watch this. Kamash nosav shaladam. What's the lifespan of a person? Shivim shana. Like David HaMelech says, 70 years, right? 70 years is a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Let's say 70 years is a lifespan. So watch this. Dal esrin delon ashtalayu. Take away 20 of those years, because up until the age of 20, a person is not held accountable in the Beis Shamala, in the heavenly court, for what they've done. So take off 20 years where there's no personal liability. Pashalu chamshin. That leaves 50 years of lifespan that a person could mess up. Dal esrin vechamisha delelusa. Take off 25 years of that 50 years, which is nighttime. What is a person doing during the nighttime? Sleeping. The assumption is you can't get into much trouble when you're sleeping. So first of all, do you understand the profound statement of that Gemara? Yitzchak Avinu says that most of us end up sleeping through half of our lifetime. So there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is when you're sleeping, you can't do anything bad. The bad news is I've slept through half of my life. I've slept through half of my life. So we're down to 25 years. 25 years that a person can get themselves into trouble. Dal tarti suryu palgo. Take off another 12 and a half years. Ditzaluye umechal udebes hakise. For 12 and a half years, a person is davening, eating, and in the bathroom. In the bathroom, right? So 12 and a half years. So the assumption is that when you're davening, eating, or in the bathroom, you're not getting yourself into any trouble either. So now, what are we left with? Pashalu tarti sari upalga. So first of all, this is amazing. Yitzchak Avinu says, "Devrei Moshe Olam." Let's just call it what it is. Out of a 70-year lifespan, the most that a person could have messed up is 12 and a half years worth. Out of an entire 70 years, apparently out of a 70-year lifetime, there's about 12 and a half years of that a person engages in dynamic life activity. Out of 70 years, there's 12 and a half years of dynamic life activity. So emotional, how much could they really have sinned? Imata sovelas kula mutav. So Yitzchak Avinu says, emotional, here's the deal. I think you, God, you emotional, have very broad shoulders. You should be able to absorb that sin. Out of 70-year lifetime, we're messing up 12 and a half years. It's pretty good. It's a pretty good return on investment for mankind. Right? So, Moshe, you should be able to forgive that, absorb it. But listen to this. Vim lav, Baruch HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if you are unwilling to absorb the full scope of the 12 and a half years, then palga alai upalga alecha. Ribono shel Olam, I will absorb half of their collective sin, and you absorb half of their collective sin. So why is this dramatically amazing? The Baal Shem Tov comments, and he says that this is the meaning of Yachatz. The three matzos represent the three avos, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. We break the middle matzah, and we go ahead, we break the Yitzchak Avinu matzah, symbolizing the idea that Yitzchak Avinu, again, was willing to literally sacrifice himself, give himself for the klal, was willing to absorb half of the guilt. Rosh Hashanah has to take half also. Yitzchak Avinu was willing to go ahead and absorb half of the collective guilt of Klal Yisrael. Why is this an important lesson? Because what it reinforces in us is an incredible idea. What Yitzchak Avinu represents is the selflessness of previous generations. That it's important for us to realize that we are here only because of the selfless sacrifice of those who came before us. Sometimes, you know, we see our lives and we all have our challenges, but we have to understand that the reason we are here, and this is as individuals and as a klal, is because we come off the heels of literally generations of Jews who sacrificed of themselves and sacrificed themselves for the continuity of our people. If Pesach is a time where we are to re-energize and reconcretize our religious identities, it is important for us to be mindful and to be appreciative of the generations who came before us, who literally gave so much. Yitzchak Avinu is not just Yitzchak Avinu. Yitzchak Avinu is representative of all of those of past generations who gave so much, so that we can have our Yiddishkeit, so that our Torah is preserved, that our communities are preserved, and that we are still here in order to be able to celebrate the Yom Tov Pesach, in order to be able to learn Torah. You know, sometimes we live in such a vacuum and we think, okay, Baruch Hashem, we're here. Of course we're here. We're here because of countless sacrifices which came before us. We're here because of immeasurable acts of selflessness that came before us. And from who? From regular people. Again, the truth is, we don't even have to go far. We don't have to go so far back. You know, one of the most profound haggadahs that I have seen in the last number of years is Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, the former chief rabbi of Israel, now the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, who himself was a survivor, wrote a commentary on the haggadah called Yach El Yisrael. And in it, he weaves in so much of the narrative of his own survivor experience into the narrative of the Haggadah. You know, literally, we don't have to span back to 2,000, 2,500 years ago to understand what it means to rebuild a people from the ashes. We don't even have to go back 100 years to understand the enormity of what it means to rebuild Klal Yisrael through the sacrifice and through the selflessness of people who came before us. Again, there are still people who rebuilt from the ashes. Unfortunately, the survivor community is one that is quickly dying out. But there are still remnants. There are still the sparks from that fire who are still here. So we come to the Pesach Seder. You know, sometimes we krechts a little bit about our Yiddishkeit. Let's be honest, right? We like to krechts. But understand, what are we krechts about? What are we krechts about? I krechts that, you know, I wish there was a greater dessert selection of kosher Pesach desserts, right? Or I krechts that, you know what? The Pesach kosher, the kosher Pesach pizza doesn't really taste like real pizza, right? Or I krechts that, you know what? Saving Center, A to Z or 7 Mile Market, they ran out of that thing that I want. That's what we krechts about. That's what we krechts about. I can't believe Shmura Matzah costs so much money. Yes, it does cost a lot of money. But those are the things that we krechts about. Those are the things that are the challenges to our Yiddishkeit. Shechyanu v'kiyemanu v'higyanu. That those are the things that we krechts about. We don't krechts about pogroms. We don't krechts about overt anti-Semitism, although it absolutely exists. We don't krechts about our ability to observe how we want, when we want, in the fashion we want. How did we get to this time? How did we privilege to be able to live it literally in a golden age of Jewry? That is the time in Jewry. Doesn't mean there aren't problems. It doesn't mean there aren't challenges, but make no mistake, we live in a golden age of Jewry. There is an incredible, overwhelming amount of Talmud Torah, probably more than in any time in the recent past history. More Jews learning, more access to learning, especially again in the Frum community, is an incredible rise on so many different levels. How do we merit this? Of course, we merit it because Kadosh Baruch Hu gave it to us. But what is it that pushed HaKadosh Baruch Hu? What is it that encouraged Ribono Shel Olam to give this to us? Because you have to understand something. The Ribono Shel Olam saw the Mesiras Nefesh of our people over the last 2,000 years. He saw the Mesiras Nefesh, what happened in the Churban. He saw the Mesiras Nefesh during the Crusades. He saw the Mesiras Nefesh during the Inquisition. He saw the Mesiras Nefesh during the pogroms. He saw the Mesiras Nefesh during the Holocaust. He saw all of this Mesiras Nefesh. We are the beneficiary of generations of selfless sacrifice for Torah and for Yiddishkeit. We are reaping all of those benefits. So at the Pesach Seder, when we break Yachatz, we just have to remember that we are here on the shoulders of great people. That we are able to live, Baruch Hashem, able to enjoy our Torah, and able to enjoy our mitzvos, and our relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, because of the incredible and overwhelming sacrifice of all those who came before us. We are only here because of the Yitzchak Avinus of our people. We're only here because that middle matzah was broken and there were so many who were willing to go ahead and take on so much for the benefit and the continuity of Klal Yisrael. And it's our job, ultimately, again, to reflect on that and to appreciate that, whether it's with word or in thought, but just to recognize that we are here because of Mesiras Nefesh. And I would take it one step further. What that means is it's our job that if we're going to go ahead and pave the way for future generations, we also have to be Moser Nefesh. Every Jew is required to engage in Mesiras Nefesh. You know, different generations had different levels of Mesiras Nefesh. But if we live in a time where quote-unquote Yiddishkeit is so easy, and it is. It is. If you think about it in the grand scheme of things, it's easy. It's easy. You're not going to lose your job for being Shomer Shabbos. You're not going to lose your parnasa for being Shomer Shabbos. Okay, we know yeshiva education, day school education is expensive, but Baruch Hashem, we have a whole variety of different choices. So what's our Mesiras Nefesh? Each of us has to find something to be Moser Nefesh for, to really sacrifice for our Yiddishkeit in order to pave the way for the generations ahead. That's Yachatz. So I'll share with you one last approach. So again, I just want to point out, none of these ideas are mutually exclusive. They all work together. So we have Yachatz, ultimately, again, representing Kriyas Yamsuf, representing the idea that we have hope, we have optimism, even in the midst of difficulty, even in the midst of pain. We have Yachatz ultimately reminding us that the third Beis HaMikdash is going to be more beautiful than anything we've ever seen, even more beautiful than the second Beis HaMikdash, because the second Beis HaMikdash was missing half of its matzah. Ultimately, again, the third Beis HaMikdash, Messianic redemption, will be full, will be complete, will be perfect. We break the middle matzah to remember, again, the sacrifice of those who came before us, to appreciate that sacrifice, and then to figure out, what is my Mesiras Nefesh going to be? How am I going to be most nefesh for HaKadosh Baruch Hu and for Yiddishkeit. And lastly, we come to the following. Look at number 12. I actually mentioned this a little bit on Shabbos, and then only afterwards I realized that it really has, I think, an incredible tie-in to the Pesach Seder as well. So we have to begin on a little bit of a detour. So remember again, over the last number of weeks, we were reading about Melechas HaMishkan, the creation and the fabrication of the Mishkan. So we have four parshios that are dedicated to the Mishkan. Shuma Tetzaveh, and then Vayakel Pekudei. So remember again, why do we need four parshios? Now essentially, if you look at it, Vayakel Pekudei, the last two parshios of the Torah, are pretty much mirror images of Truman Tetzaveh. Why do I need duplicate parshios? Because remember, Truman Tetzaveh tells me what Klal Yisrael was going to do. Vayakel Pekudei tells me that they did it, which is an incredible lesson in life. There are many people with beautiful dreams and beautiful aspirations, and they go through life saying, I'm going to do this. Only one problem, which is they never do it. Dreams are fantastic. Aspirations are wonderful. But even better than dreams and aspirations is to execute on the details, to carry through. So Vayakel Pekudei tells us Klal Yisrael didn't just dream big, they did big as well. And the Torah goes out of it to the Torah doesn't spare one detail. And this is very important. Remember, if today, if you wanted to build a replica of the Mishkan, could you do so? And the answer is unequivocally yes. Why? Because the Torah gives us every single measurement down to the last amma. There is nothing that is missing from the Mishkan. We know the dimensions of anything and everything. That's why it's amazing. If you ever go to the Machon HaMikdash, to the Temple Institute in the old city of Yerushalayim, so it's amazing that they have reconstructed certain things that Halavai will be using the Bayis Shlishi. So how do they know how to do it? It's simple, because the Torah gives us the dimensions. It's not a secret. The Torah gives us the literal dimensions for every single thing used in the Mishkan and by extension in the Beis HaMikdash. But I'll show you something fascinating. Take a look at number 12. So the Pasuk says, remember, so at the end of Parshas Pekudei, they bring everything to Moshe Rabbeinu. They bring all of the pieces, and again, Moshe Rabbeinu's job is to assemble everything. So, Vayikach, Vayiten, Asa'idus, Al-Aron. So what does Moshe Rabbeinu do? He goes and he takes the Luchos, right? The Eidos are the Luchos, the tablets, places them in the Ark, Vayosem, Asa'badim, Al-Aron. He places the poles in the Ark. Remember again, the Aron was unique in that many of the larger utensils, the Shulchan, the table, the Mizbeach, or the Mizbechos, both altars, had poles that were inserted for traveling purposes. But when the object was at rest, the pole was removed. The Aron was the only utensil where once the poles were inserted, they were never removed. So Moshe Rabbeinu puts in the poles, Vayitin Esakapores ala Aron milamal. Then he places the lid on top of the Aron. So places the tablets inside, places the poles, and then places the lid. Fine. Interesting, but nothing out of the ordinary. Take a look at number 13. Targum Yonasan. This is Rabbi Yonasan ben Uziel. Remember, Yonasan ben Uziel was the Talmud Muvak, the primary disciple of Hillel. Remember, again, this was an interesting shir. The Gemara tells us that Hillel had a number of Talmidim. The top of the class was Yonasan ben Uziel, who was, quote-unquote, the low man on the totem pole. Who was at the bottom of the shir? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Can you imagine? Can you imagine that Beis Medrash? Can you imagine that Beis Medrash? Right? So you have Yonasan ben Uziel at the top of the shir, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, quote unquote, at the bottom of the shir. Doesn't mean he was the weakest student. It actually means he was the youngest of the Chevra who was part of Hillel's Talmidim. So Yonasan ben Uziel wrote a commentary on the Chumash, the first Targum in Aramaic. Unkelus comes afterwards. Yonasan ben Uziel is first. He goes and he writes a targum on the Chumash. That targum is not just a translation. It is a commentary written in the vernacular, written in the Aramaic vernacular. So Yonasan ben Uziel writes the following. Number 13. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But he writes, if you look in the second line, Hinon luchei sadusa, Moshe Rabbeinu puts in the tablets. And look what Yonasan ben Uziel says. V'tavrei luchaya ba'arona. And what else does he put in the aron? Tavri. Remember, in Aramaic, so shin and saf are interchangeable. So tavre is shavre. What else does Moshe Rabbeinu put in the ark? Shivrei luchos, the broken tablets. And there, so Moshe Rabbeinu puts in the whole tablets, second tablets, puts in the first tablets as well as shivrei luchos. And there's an obvious question, which is, Ribono Shel Olam, you did not leave out any detail from the Mishkan. Every single thing is included, mamish till the last cubit. So, why are you leaving this out? Why don't you tell me? Why doesn't the Torah tell me that Moshe Rabbeinu put in the shivrei luchos? In fact, I want to tell you something even interesting. I would have thought, just based on the text, what happened to the Shivrei Luchos, what happened to the broken tablets? What would you have assumed happened to them? Hashem took them. I would have thought nothing. Right? Meaning, who says the Shivrei Luchos have any kind of Kedusha? Moshe and threw it down, we're done. We're done. I would have thought he left them by the base of Mount Sinai. I wouldn't have even thought that he collected them afterwards. Now I find out, by the way, not only did Moshe Rabbeinu collect the broken tablets, right? Because remember again, I want to be clear. The psukim, the text itself, makes no reference about anything regarding the first set of broken tablets. The last time I heard about the first set of tablets was when? When Moshe Rabbeinu comes down and he throws them down. That's it. And throws them that they broke. That's it. But the story's closed. So I would have thought they're just rocks. Now, again, remember, at the end of the day, once Moshe Rabbeinu throws them down, then they're rocks. Or at least I would have thought that they're just rocks. Yes, rocks that were written by God. But they're rocks. I would assume he left them by the mountain. But yet, no, he gathered them up. Not only did he gather them up, but he placed them in the Aron. So tell me, in a parasha that is so detail-oriented, so detail-focused, why is this piece of information left out? Sashay is something amazing. Take a look for a moment at number 17. The Ibn Ezra writes something dramatically amazing. We're not going to go through this whole thing right now. But the Ibn Ezra writes as follows. Listen, parasha's Kisisa. Vayomer HaGon. So the Ibn Ezra quotes this Gon. I don't know who the Gon is that he's referring to. Ki Ashniim Nichbate Meharishon B'Shiva Drachim. This Gaon that the Ibn Ezra says, you see, the parts that I skipped is where the Gemara extols the virtues of the first set of tablets. So the Gemara discusses that had Moshe Rabbeinu never broken the first set of tablets, Torah would never be forgotten from Klal Yisrael. In other words, had we accepted the Torah through the mechanism or through the vehicle of the first set of tablets, we would have enjoyed a much closer relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and a spiritually heightened experience. So, I'm sorry? But he broke them. I can make the counter argument. The fact that Moshe Rabbeinu broke them tells me that they don't have Kiddusha. Meaning Moshe Rabbeinu's Svara seems to be that if Klal Yisrael, you abdicated your religious identity, then these tablets are meaningless. Again, otherwise, remember, the act of throwing something written by God down to the ground, I don't think it was Moshe Rabbeinu's expectation, I don't know, but I don't know that it was Moshe Rabbeinu's expectations that I'm going to throw it down, but I'll gather up the pieces and treat them nicely. Moshe Rabbeinu feels, if this is how you're acting, then this is meaningless to you. So the act of throwing, meaning, remember, Moshe Rabbeinu could have just said, God, hold these for a second. I'll be back. Let me see what's going on down there. Let's see what's happening. He doesn't do that. Right? He doesn't set it down nicely on the side. He destroys them. Now, again, there are many reasons why he destroys them. On a basic level, you can't destroy something that you believe has inherent Kedusha. That would be a defamation to God. That would be a desecration of God. So Moshe Rabbeinu's cheshbon was, remember, you know, I'll give you the perfect example to this. You could have a beautifully written Sefer Torah, right? But if it was written by a heretic, what's the status of the Torah? It's pasul. You could throw it in the garbage. You could literally throw it in the garbage. You don't even have to double wrap it. You could just throw it in the garbage. Because when it comes to Torah, it's not just the words, but it's the kavanas. Those luchos were given to Moshe from HaKadosh Baruch Hu as a way of concretizing and solidifying a beautiful and spiritually intimate relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When one of the parties has checked out of the relationship, then the vehicle becomes meaningless. So the Gemara, and I only quote a couple of sources, but the Gemara discusses that the first set of tablets were much holier than the second. Right? The seconds were great, and the Gemara makes many comparisons. The first one were written by God, right? Written by God in the script of God. The second ones were written by Moshe. A number of different comparisons. Had we received the first, we would have never forgotten Torah. Now the second, we do forget Torah at times. The Ibn Ezra quotes this Gon, and this Gon says that the second set of tablets were better than the first in seven different ways. And the Gon goes on to exist. Gon, again, I don't know who this Gon is that he's quoting. But this Gaon goes on to enumerate seven different ways in which the second set of luchos are better than the first. But skip down to the end. You see where it's underlined, Ve'in Sorech? So look what the Ibn Ezra says. He quotes these seven different ideas, and this is an amazing Ibn Ezra. Ve'in Sorech l'hashel divrei ha-Gaon zeh. The Ibn Ezra says, the truth is, I don't have to comment on these words of this Gaon. Ki re'isim hein. I've seen them, meaning I've studied them. And what ki re'isim hein? Ki divrei chalom. I think these words are like a dream. Lo ma'alim v'lo moridim. They don't help and they don't hurt. In other words, I've seen the seven reasons of the Gaon. It's fine, interesting. Ki yadua, ki michtav acharon, ki michtav harishon, michtav elokim hu. Because ultimately, again, says the Gaon, says the Ibn Ezra, everyone knows that the second set of luchos are just as good as the first. Vihinehim b'michtav shavim miharishonim. And ultimately, again, the second set are just as good as the first. So what's going on over here? What a strange Ibn Ezra. And this is not like the normal derech of the Ibn Ezra, either stylistically. So the Ibn Ezra goes ahead and says, essentially, I wanted just to frame this in the right way. The Ibn Ezra quotes the Gaon. The Gaon gives seven reasons as to why the second set of tablets are better than the first. The Ibn Ezra says, I've studied the reasons, not impressed. Lo ma'alim v'lo maridim. It's fine. Kedivrei chalom. It doesn't make such an impact on me. All I know is that what? That the second tablets are better or just as good as the first. What's the pshat? I think the Ibn Ezra is teaching us an incredible, incredible lesson. That life is not about objective side-by-side comparisons. Life is not about comparing what you have now to what you might have had in the past. Life is all about maximizing what you have now in your present. The Ibn Ezra says, so okay, you want to sit down and you want to analyze, were the first set of luchos better than the second? And what do you gain from that? Well, let's say the first set of luchos were better than the second set of luchos. So what? What do I end up with then? Sadness and depression over what I've lost. Instead, says the Ibn Ezra, in life, you can't compare what was, what could have been, what should have been, to what is. Because at the end of the day, that is an exercise in futility that only engenders despondency, sadness, and sometimes hopelessness. Rather, says the Ibn Ezra, sometimes in life, you just have to accept the fact that what you have is quote-unquote the best. What you have is the best. Ibn Ezra says something amazing. He says, you think everyone has shivrei luchos. Everyone has broken tablets. What do the broken tablets represent? You know, the Gemara paints this beautiful picture. Oh, had we only received the first set of tablets, do you know what life could have looked like? Life would have been so fantastic. We all have broken tablets, right? We all have broken tablets. Broken tablets either from missed opportunities, broken tablets from unrealized dreams, broken tablets ultimately from aspirations we had, but for whatever the reason, either because of our actions or actions of others, never materialized. Broken tablets because I thought life was going in one direction, and suddenly the Ribbono Shel Olam threw me a curveball, and suddenly my life is going in a different direction. We all have shivrei kelim. We all have shivrei luchos. We all have broken tablets. We all have the beautiful dreams, aspirations, the life that once was, but is no longer. So now, I have my second set of luchos. So the question is, what do you do with the second set of luchos? So you have a choice. You could spend your life comparing the second luchos to the first. You could spend your life looking, well, this one had this one doesn't have this. Or you could say, you know what? These are the luchos I have. This second set is what I've got. And I'm not going to spend my life thinking about what could have been, what should have been, what may have been. Instead, I'm going to focus myself on maximizing what is. The Ibn Ezra says, the second set of luchos are just as good as the first. Do you know why? Because it's what I've got. And if this is what I've got, then by definition, it's excellent. If this is what I've got, then this is the circumstances I have to deal with, then it's my job not to lament, it's my job not to compare, but it's my job to maximize. But I'll tell you something amazing. You see, if you'll notice again, the luchos rishonos are still taken with us, right? If you notice, we don't discard them. We put them in the aron. Why do we put them in the aron? Because bringing your broken tablets is very important, for one simple reason. Because every once in a while, you have to glance at the broken tablets, and you have to remember what happens when you don't seize your life opportunities. You have to remember what happens when you don't try to cause your dreams to materialize. You have to remember what happens when you don't roll up your sleeves and work hard in life. So ultimately, again, those broken tablets are there with me. They're sitting in the aron, and every once in a while, I have to look at them, but that's not what I focus on. I don't focus on what was. I don't focus on what could have been, what should have been, what may have been. I don't focus on the beauty of the past. Instead, I focus on maximizing what I have in the present. Those second luchos are what I have. Therefore, says the Ibn Ezra, that's the best I'm going to get. And if this second luchos is what I've got, then I need to figure out how to maximize them. The Torah HaKadosha does not mention the broken luchos intentionally. In a parsha that is so detail-oriented, HaKadosh Baruch Hu leaves out any mention of the first set of luchos. Why? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want me focusing on the broken luchos of the past. HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not want me focusing on the broken or shattered dreams or aspirations, on the broken life that once was. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants me focusing on maximizing the second set of luchos that I have. These are the luchos I have, says the Ibn Ezra. Therefore, by definition, these are the best set of luchos that I can have in my given circumstances at this time. My job is not to compare. My job is not to reflect. My job is not to lament. My job is one simple thing. Take the luchos you've got and figure out a way to maximize them. And perhaps this is the symbolism in Yachatz. Remember again, we take matzah. What does matzah represent? What does matzah represent? So remember again, either way you answer this, you're okay. Right? Matzah represents many different things. Many, many, many different things. In fact, you know what the amazing part about matzah is? What does matzah taste like?
Cardboard.
Right, cardboard. Good. The real answer is, matzah tastes like whatever you choose it to taste. You know, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov writes that the matzah is like the mun. So you say to yourself, really? I always thought I hope the matzah is not like the mun. Right? So what does that mean, matzah is like the mun? You know the amazing part about matzah? Matzah takes on the flavor of whatever additive or condiment you place on it. So you put X on it, it tastes like X. You put Y on it, it tastes like Y. Matzah doesn't have an independent taste on its own. It absorbs the taste of whatever. Matzah represents the bread of freedom. Matzah represents the bread of salvation. Matzah represents the bread of opportunities. It's purposely tasteless. It's tasteless by design. Because again, it's not up to the baker to infuse the taste into my freedom. It's up to me to infuse the taste of my freedom. I am free. I am a Ben Chorin. Rabbeinu Shalom gives us all on the night of Pesach, over the Yom Tov of Pesach, a new dose of freedom kite, right? A new dose of being a Bnei Chorin, a new dose of being free. What does it mean to be free? Being free means I can help determine the course and trajectory of my destiny. No, I can't control all of the variables. And I can't control all of the stuff that happens, but I control my reaction. I control what I do. I control I'm going to act. I can control my disposition. I can control my reaction. That's why matzah is the bread of freedom. Because it tastes like whatever you want it to taste like. You want to dip your matzah into something bitter? It's going to be bitter. You want to sprinkle a little sugar on it? Suddenly it becomes sweet. You can do whatever you want with that matzah. Why? Because we are free. But lest you think for a moment that freedom means that everything is going to go according to plan. Lest you think that freedom means that now everything is great, we left Mitzrayim, and clearly life is just going to be a piece of cake. It's not true. What do? We break the middle matzah. And perhaps the breaking of the middle matzah represents the shivrei luchos. The breaking of the middle matzah represents that sometimes life gets broken. Sometimes we get broken. No, it's not the right English, but you understand. Sometimes we break. Sometimes, again, what looked so beautiful, what looked so wonderful. You know, sometimes if you're preparing for the Seder, you know how when you open up, like in that moment of incredible faith, when you open up your Shmura matzah box and you wonder, you know, mamish, like what's going to be on the inside? And you know, some you want to find beautiful matzahs for the Seder. You know, sometimes you find the beautiful matzah, but then again, there's a nick on the corner. You need shleimus, so it's not shalim. You know, life is a matzah. That matzah represents freedom. That matzah represents opportunities. But at the Leil HaSeder, what we say is, be prepared for your matzah to break. Be prepared. For your dreams, I'm not going to use the word to be shattered because that sounds too dramatic. But sometimes to break a little bit. Be concerned, be prepared for your circumstances to break a little bit. Be prepared for your luchos, for your tablets to be smashed. Because such is the nature of the human condition. There is no one person that gets their first set of tablets, that gets their matzahs, and keeps those same tablets or those same matzahs with them through the entirety of life. In life, what happens is usually the tablets don't get smashed just once. Usually they get smashed repeated times over. But here's the amazing part. No matter how many times my luchos are smashed, I'm always given a second set. Even though, again, my middle matzah is broken, the top one is whole, the bottom one is whole. The matzah, which represents the bread of freedom, the bread of opportunity. And the same time when we rejoice in our newfound opportunities, we embrace the realities of the human condition. We break the middle matzah, symbolizing the breakage of our freedom, the breakage of our opportunity, the non-materialization of our dreams and aspirations, because such is the nature of the human condition. But while we do that, that's not done to be as a downer. That's done to ultimately gird ourselves with the right kind of strength, to say, you know what? Even if my matzah does break, I'll get another one, and that second one will be the best matzah. Aye, but one second. That second matzah is not as good as the first. You remember the way that first matzah looked? That first matzah, mamish, was beautiful, right? That first matzah, that was a 10. That mamish was a 10. It was perfect. It was perfect. That second matzah, it's not really a 10. Maybe it's a 7. Maybe it's a 6. And I say, the matzah that I've got is the matzah that's perfect. The luchos that I have are the luchos that are perfect. Because life is not about preparing, is not about comparing my present matzah to the past matzah. Life is not about comparing the second luchos to the first luchos. Life is about taking the circumstances you have and figuring out a way to maximize them, and not spending my life comparing those luchos to what was or what could have been and what should have been. And herein lies perhaps the incredible message that Chazal were ultimately trying to teach us through Yachatz. Take a look at number 18. I'll end with this. The Baal Shem, it's a Tehillim class. I have to end off with the Pasuk in Tehillim. David HaMelech says in Perek Ayin Aleph 71, Atashlicheni le'eis zikna. Atashlicheni le'eis zikna. Rebbe Shalom, do not cast me away at the time of old age. Kichlos kochi al ta'azveni. As my strength wanes, do not forsake me. We say this, we say this pasuk a lot, especially during Yomim Noraim, during the high holidays. And the truth is, you don't even need any kind of like deeper interpretation of the pasuk. Is kind of self-explanatory. David HaMelech is literally saying, when I get old, and perhaps I can't take care of myself as I once did, don't leave me. Don't leave me, Chazal. Promise me you're going to be by my side even as my physical strength wanes. The Baal Shem Tov HaKadosh says a little bit differently. He says, zikna doesn't just mean old age. Zikna means the past. He says, al tashlicheni le'es zikna means, don't let me be the kind of person who always lives in the past. There are some people who are always living with the memories of their first luchos. There are some people who are always living with the memories of their home matzos. And all that does is create a lifetime of pain. Because I can't reclaim those first luchos. And I can't reclaim that whole matzah. Because once it's broken, it often cannot be repaired. Don't let me be one of those people who lives an entire lifetime. You know, there are people like this. There are people who just can never move on. There are people who get so stuck in the fact that I no longer have my first luchos. There are some people who get so stuck in the fact that my matzah is no longer whole that it paralyzes them from moving forward. And sometimes understandably so, because you're dealing with incredible life trauma and incredible life adversity. But the alternative is so much better. The alternative is accepting the luchos you have, even if they're not as beautiful as the luchos you once had. Accepting the matzah you have, even if it's not as beautiful as the matzah you once had. And here lies the symbolism of Yachatz. Chazal trying to teach us an incredible lesson. Then on the Yom Tov of Pesach, when we celebrate the new beginning, and we celebrate our newfound freedom, and we celebrate the ability to forge our destiny and forge our identity, we recognize that not everything goes according to plan. The first set of luchos are often lost. The first matzahs are often broken. But I pledge to myself, and I pledge to Ribbono Shel Olam, thank you for giving me a new start. Thank you at least for allowing me to begin with three whole matzahs, with the first set of luchos. I'm going to break the matzah, because I recognize that over the journey of life, the tablets break, the matzahs break. But I pledge to Yirak HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I pledge to myself, that when those matzahs break, and when those luchos break, I will find the courage to get the second luchos. I'll find the courage to bake myself a new matzah. And even if those second luchos are not as beautiful as the first, and even if that first matzah is not as perfect as the first, I will never spend my life lamenting what I had and what I lost. Instead, I'll focus on solidifying and using my energy to maximize the luchos that I have, to maximizing the matzah that I have, to maximizing the life that I have. Wishing all of you a chag kasher v'sameach.